coming up on Path to Zero.
We just have the one Earth. There are these environmental issues that, you know, need to be taken seriously. And I guess that's mainly what ESG should be about. And that's what it's been about from the very beginning.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Hello, Path to Zero listeners. In this episode, you'll hear about a new way to stay on top of the latest news on climate change, impacts, and solutions. We're going to be talking to Reuters journalist Sharon Kitts Kamathi. She created and manages the content for the Reuters Sustainable Switch newsletter, which covers how companies and governments are grappling with climate change, diversity, and human rights. Reuters is one of the largest and most trusted news agencies in the world, with more than 2,500 journalists covering the news. Stick around to the end of the episode, and I'll let you know how you can pre-order my forthcoming book, also called Path to Zero. But first, we welcome our guest, Sharon Kitts Kamathi, who is the ESG and energy editor at Reuters. Sharon is the creator, curator, and editor of the Reuters Sustainable Switch newsletter and the Sustainable Business Vertical on Reuters.com. We're pleased that she is joining us from London today. Welcome to Path to Zero, Sharon. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Thank you so, so much for having me. I'm really excited to dive into all these topics you've got for me.
Well, we've certainly got a lot to talk about, but let's go right to Sustainable Switch, the newsletter that you lead at Reuters. Tell our listeners about the Reuters approach, maybe their approach to climate journalism, and then talk about Sustainable Switch.
Well, Reuters' approach to climate journalism is very similar to its approach across the board with all of its journalism, to be honest, and that's mainly adhering to the Reuters Trust Principles. So it's mainly about transparency, integrity, and just basically ensuring that we give our readers and our audience, you know, journalistic principles of independence, objectivity, and impartiality. So that also is the same for our climate coverage and our environment coverage too. I would say in terms of Sustainable Switch and how it fits in with that, it's covering a broad range of topics within the space. Of course, it's not just the environment, but it's also social issues and governance issues as well. And with that, of course, that might end up seeming like it might be a bit polarizing, but so long as I stick to the impartial elements of it and the objective elements using scientific research, market trends, initiatives, stuff like that, as you've probably read on Sustainable Switch, then you'll see that I try and maintain the line, a very thin line between objectivity and any sort of bias that can be had within this space, as you can imagine.
That's funny. I find this topic very polarizing. In fact, probably the most polarizing of any of the topics I tend to tread into, where some people have such clear views in almost opposite directions. So let's talk about Sustainable Switch. When you created it, and it's really nice to note that you did create it. What was your main objective? And then, you know, when our listeners are thinking about you and that newsletter, what do you want them to know about it?
Well, to be honest, the main objective from the start was to reach people like yourself, to be honest, right? We wanted a product that would resonate with everyone from industry leaders like yourself, professionals in the ESG and energy space, investors, regulators, NGOs, all the way to students and people who are just generally interested to learn more about climate change, social issues, and everything in between. So we tried to package it in a way that was easily digestible as well. So having that intro, using voices from the industry as well within in conversation, and also quote of the day. And then for those who have stuck with Sustainable Switch from the very beginning 2 years ago, they would probably notice that we had the ESG movers and shakers. And that was a short-lived section that was mainly about people in the industry being hired or like looking for jobs, within the renewables and ESG space, but we quickly learned that actually that's not very entertaining for our audience. So that was switched to something that resonated a little bit more with our readership, and that was the ESG Spotlight. So that's more like initiatives around the world that people are putting in place, not only to tackle climate change, but any sort of social issues or environment issues and corporate governance, stuff like that, just like innovative little projects. There's one that I'll be covering, for example, tomorrow. That's a farm in Mexico, and they are trying to protect bees. So using, you know, their own initiatives to go out there, find bees, protect them, keep them in safe and like habitats that will ensure that they can populate, because of course there's a declining bee population, and it's happening around the world. So yeah, it's just small initiatives, and which is one of my favorite spots in Switch. So yeah, it was just to reach people in an easily digestible format, and just make sure that it's on people's radars, to be honest, because it's a wide topic, and I guess it does take quite a lot to digest, especially using our vast array of networks and reporters and journalists around the world. So trying to gather the best, most thematically linked stories to give to our audience was the main objective.
Yeah, well done. I mean, good, clear information is so important, because in this whole matter, there's quite a bit of, I don't know, unknown, quite a bit of subjective information. So it's lovely that, you know, to get your goal. You know, you've already talked about it a couple times today, ESG. And just for those of you who I know most of you would know, environmental, social, and governance issues. Interestingly, in the U.S., we've seen maybe the last 6 months or so, a lot of people have turned against ESG, which I'm sad for, because I always thought having a scorecard was the right way to do it. But it's, so many people would suspect, it's a little bit been politicized. How do you think we move forward in maybe a constructive way to keep ESG alive without giving it to really maybe people on either end or the politicians?
Yeah, I did touch on that. And I guess from the Reuters perspective, through sifting through a bunch of our stories that we've seen, it's mainly about focusing on what ESG was all about from the very beginning. So our stories do capture these social corporate initiatives that have been put in place to essentially address corporate responsibility, right? And that was the very start of ESG. Before it became known as ESG, it was CSR, which was an audit, just a way for businesses to provide a formula to their stakeholders of measuring their social responsibility. And we've seen that throughout our reportage on Reuters. When it comes to the annual general meeting season, we talk about, you know, Exxon and, you know, those shareholders that stood up to those big bosses about, you know, making sure they can crack down on net zero, their emissions targets being appalling, and just to improve on that. So that's mainly sort of the crux, the foundation of what it is, was that it is a business audit formula. But since then, it's sort of, I guess, deviated away from more of a business approach and has encompassed a more holistic, I suppose, to be honest, integrated approach of not just social responsibility, as it were, from the beginning, but it's now moved on to environmental sustainability. It's probably because of, you know, seeing a lot of research on, you know, climate change and extreme weather events that are driven by climate change interfering not only with just day-to-day society, but also with business. So, you know, you can see factories being shut down because of tornadoes, or workers suffering from extreme heat when they're out there constructing buildings, or, you know, in factories, textile factories, manufacturers in car industries, and all manner of industries were basically getting affected by actual extreme weather events driven scientifically through research by climate change. So because of that, it seems like a lot of people have sort of taken umbrage with being told that, you know what, climate change is a very real thing and it's affecting not only your day-to-day life, but it's affecting your business, there's now been some sort of pushback to say, hang on a minute, how has it affected our business? Why? So we've seen with farmers protests, for example, in Europe, there's been a lot of farmers protests, and I covered that quite a bit in Sustainable Switch. Their main pushback was not only just with their tax systems that are hurting them, but it was the environmental regulations that were coming in place. So you see these industries retreating away from just trying to essentially maintain our environment. I speak to a lot of scientists who often tell me one thing, and that is we only have one Earth, and they can't get that message across more clearly that we just have the one Earth. So everyone sort of needs to get on board, stop the pushback and get in line is mainly what a lot of scientists and researchers tell me. So I suppose the one thing I could say can make it cohesive is to use that message, is we just have the one Earth. Everyone needs to get in line. There are these environmental issues that, you know, need to be taken seriously. And I guess that's mainly what ESG should be about. And that's what it's been about from the very beginning.
Yes, great answer. Thank you. You know, I followed the protests from the farmers really closely because one, we really haven't seen much of that yet in the U.S., but I'm quick to say most of Europe is probably ahead of us. But the one thing that strikes me there and also strikes me here, in fact, I saw a report yesterday, our food costs in the U.S. are up about 30% since 2018, I think, is an area that you do cover quite a bit, is kind of the intersection of climate action and justice or equity. When you think, I guess part of what the farmers were saying in Europe is this is unfair to us as farmers. You're singling us out to ask us to do things that perhaps others aren't doing. But the other embedded protest, I think, in there is this is going to make my farm quite difficult, and it's going to make my products far more expensive. How do you, I know you see so many different stories, but how do you begin to square the need for improving the climate with the inevitable about increase in food prices, perhaps increase in energy prices, perhaps scarcity of either or both?
It's interesting you flagged that. I get quite a lot of surveys basically that are sent to me on a day-to-day. Stick with me, I'm going somewhere with this. And a lot of them do show that consumers are happy to spend a little bit more if they know that it's going towards a specifically good cause. So if they're coming out off the bat and saying, you know, you're going to be paying more for, let's say it's your Weetabix, you're going to be paying a little bit more for your cornflakes or your Weetabix, because on it, you can prove through transparency, you've got to be transparent, that it is mainly about saving a specific plot of your land for those environmental protection and regulations, then perhaps people will get in line. Now, where it starts to hurt consumers is that often it's about the bottom line for these companies. It's about making sure that they can hike the prices, but they don't really provide reasons that a lot of the consumers find are as valid or proportionate to what's been going on. I would basically say that the one thing they need to do is just be transparent. That's all. Yes. That's what consumers want, you know? And, you know, through these multiple surveys that I get, and I'm telling you, I get them on nearly a day-to-day basis that keeps telling me, not only is it generational, across genders, across different business industries, people are willing to give a bit more in exchange for ensuring that the environment is well protected. They're willing to go into a job, maybe even for a little bit less pay than they had before, knowing that it's for a specifically good, proportionate reason. Just be transparent with people.
Yes. Well said. Sharon, I've got a lot of work I've done, you know, following your writings, but maybe before I ask you about some of your own work that fascinated me, you want to tell our listeners about a story or two that really fascinated you and maybe took you to a place you didn't expect to go?
Oh, that is a very good story. The first one I can think of immediately was one that was recently covered in the States, by an investigative journalist. And it was about the slave legacies. And it was a series. It was about four or five parts, really deep and insightful. And the first one started off with the reporter themselves, like the actual journalist, went into their own family archive and noticed that they had links to slavery. Someone in the family owned slaves. And that was the beginning of his journey of finding out a bit more about what was going on in the family and how at the end, spoiler alert, there was mixing, and he found a distant Black relative. So it was a white journalist. He found a distant Black relative, and they met, and they had a good chat, and you know, there was a lot of emotions. So that sort of emotional resolution from something so painful was so insightful, especially when it came from one of our own actual Reuters reporters and journalists, and being so open as well in talking about it was something so refreshing, and it has sat with me for quite some time. It came out, the first part, last summer, and to be honest, I do think about that every other day. And for people who are like, oh, what's it got to do with ESG? It is the S in ESG. As I always like to say, the S is very important, and people tend to shy away from the societal issues when it comes to the ESG topic. Another one that I often do think about is the massive solar farm in Portugal that is like the size of a football stadium. And not only was it the images that I think about quite a lot because it's so vast and expansive. And we had a great photojournalist team as well out there take these great bits of footage. But it just goes to show that actually people can do this. Like, you can put in work and move towards renewables. And from that Portugal story, when it came to people in the UK, for example, during the cost of living crisis and also everyone's energy bills going up, sadly, from what was going on in Ukraine, it was also like, well, the people in Portugal had a much better bill than we all did in the UK, that's for sure. So that one often also stays in my mind on a day to day, because it's like, oh, come on, guys, we can do this. They're doing it. Let's all, you know, put our efforts in and get these renewable energies using different either wind or solar out there, because it does actually benefit you in the end as a consumer.
This is a good time for a break, and we'll be right back with Sharon Kitts-Kamathi with Reuters.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a zero emissions future starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane. Energy for everyone. Learn more at propane.com.
Welcome back to Path to Zero. Our guest today is Sharon Kitts-Kamathi, the editor, curator, and really founder of the Reuters Sustainable Switch newsletter. I want to go to a different spot with you for a moment. I know you've got such a great background, trained in law, a good time spent in what I'll call corporate finance, and now journalism. And the one area that I noticed fundamentally different between how Europe is actually exacting on this climate transition in America. America is really leading with a lot of financial incentives, government-driven incentives. Europe, I would say, is far behind that, but tends to be driven, I think, by business. Using your background in law, finance, and now environmental journalism, talk about maybe what do you see as the best combination and how we get as fast as we can, but also as affordably as we can to a cleaner place?
That's a really good question. Yes, my various legal expertise still comes to use occasionally, especially within the space. I started off trying actually to cover environmental regulations in Europe And at the time, this was probably what, 20, I want to say 17, 18, I was shut down. I was shut down at the time because I'm like, oh, this is just a fad. I'm sure nothing will really happen from it. And I was like, really? I'm sure these environmental regulations will probably hinder either our sources or customers. It would be a really good thing to get into it. But basically, what it is that Europe tends to focus on regulations a lot. And as you did say, America does focus more on putting money where your mouth is. You know, with the Inflation Reduction Act, that really did incentivize a lot of people to get on board through those incentives and initiatives. And Europe seems to be using more of, you know, nail, hammer, boom, you know, approach instead of sort of talking to business leaders and seeing where those incentives can also be applied. So what I would say would be a great approach, or at least one that a lot of industry leaders have told me, so this is not coming from just my perspective, it's a lot of other industry leaders, is the approach seen in China, where it is a bit of a mixture of both. It is regulation heavy, sure, but there are also incentives. There are a lot of incentives there in order to make sure that people are looking into solar and wind and hydro. They've been pretty pivotal in the hydro space. Yes, they're still one of the high emitters, similar to America as well, with its energy, but they have got a pretty good balance of incentivizing people to get into the space, not only for work purposes. So a lot of areas that fall short in Europe right now is the lack of talent within the space. So whilst they're busy putting out all these regulations that might deter people to even bother with environmental protections, there's not even enough people going into some of these industries to actually take care of the environment and renewables in the future. So the way it should start, from what I've seen with business leaders and talking to people like yourself, Tucker, is mainly to start with like a carrot before you use the stick. And I feel like with Europe, it's mainly been the other way around. So perhaps starting off with incentives, saying that we're going to pour in, you know, all of these Eurobonds. I mean, there's so many things that they tend to throw money at. So, you know, putting in money towards young people getting into the space, towards small businesses that are looking to get into the space, and giving them that funding, because there's quite a lot of fantastic small businesses that I talk to on the regular about needing more capital in order to branch out and really, you know, put their work into actual consumer homes when it comes to energy and renewables, not only solar panels in your homes, but also combi boilers in the UK, or ensuring that there's no drafts coming through your windows, just small initiatives like that. So being able to fund those projects will make a difference. And then that's when you can use those regulations to say, oh, hang on a minute, perhaps you need to fix X, Y, Z in order to make sure your goals are achievable. So that's what I'd say, incentive first.
Well, I'm going to give you points, because I think, I mean, this is well over my 100th interview, and you are probably one of three or four people that drift back eventually to conservation. And it's I find it so interesting that we talk about growth. We rarely ever talk about conserving what we have. You talk about it by having better windows and doors and insulation, but it can, and by the way, I think Europe showed it can be done. You turn your thermostats down at a time when I'd never seen that happen, but I always applaud people who talk about even using less of what we have just as a part of their normal lifestyle. Well, well said for that. We're going to have a little fun in a second, but I like to ask a question that I think is often asked in fun, but it arguably could be the most important part of this whole show. I want to hand you a magic wand, and you've earned that right, because you really have this great position of, you know, being part, as you say often, about being part of an ethical organization that reports worldwide view. You're just in the middle of this conversation. If I gave you a magic wand to change one thing in the next year regarding climate change, sustainability, maybe I'll even give you that broad brush around ESG. Sharon, how would you use that magic wand?
Oh, That is a fantastic question. And I do wonder how everyone else has used their magical powers. I would mainly focus on the fossil fuel phase out, because the fossil fuel phase out has been a huge topic, not only within our Reuters coverage, but within this industry. And I would use that wand and go towards all of the energy shareholders, put them all in one place and magically say, hey guys, oil's no longer attractive. It's icky. Let's not do that anymore. Let's put all our focus on solar and wind and hydro. No more oil. Just like that. Just within a blink of an eye and see what happens. See if there's going to be any big change.
Yeah, good. It's certainly, I mean, from occupying a position of dominant number one. So you say oil. Is it about oil or is it about coal? Is it about natural gas? Is it about all of the above?
The whole spectrum, to be honest. I know it's very hard for some places to shy away from coal, hence the focus just on oil, because it's mainly these big developing or developed countries that have focused on oil for a lot of years. And they have, of course, a big coal output. But from what I see in the developed regions in the global south, some of them do end up relying on coal still. And there's, you know, it would impact them in a way that would be incredibly dramatic, such as India. India do still rely heavily on coal. So at the minute, to not rock the boat too much, I know King Coal is bad and he will be dealt with, but my focus at the moment would be that one specifically for oil. Maybe gas, but oil.
Yeah, look, I tend to agree with you. I think oil is inherently dirty and getting dirtier. And there are, I personally would say that the migration away from coal and oil, at least to natural gas, to propane, and then clearly to other renewable forms of energy, including renewable natural gas, renewable propane, certainly is a movement in the right direction. So you walk me into one more question, because I love, you know, you're sitting in London, you got clear views that are shaped, you know, not only by you, but by kind of the environment you live in specifically. And you talk about a term I don't really like, the developing South. I really like to think about developing nations, and their argument is so straightforward. We haven't contributed to this mess. We are far behind and taking away. I'm not going to go with oil or coal right now, because I do find that those should be considered as fuels of the past. But taking away our ability to use more propane, more natural gas, you know, to ban clean fuels like natural gas would be an injustice to us. And certainly it would probably raise their cost of energy. How do you think about the developed world versus the developing world and what choices they get to make?
Oh, it's always a topic that tends to rock the boat quite a bit. And I would say through reading our coverage on such events as there was the bio conference in Nairobi not that long ago, I think it was just a couple of weeks ago, and there was the argument of, okay, we will stop in the global south thinking about these, as you mentioned, the fuels of the past, if you provide the climate finance that was agreed upon. And I think that was the main issue is that it comes down to money. As I even mentioned earlier, right? You've got to give those incentives. You have to give that carrot before, you know, thinking about using the stick. The global north or the west or developed nations, all these other words that we used to just say, rich countries. The rich countries that have benefited from using these dirty fuels do need to pay up. Give that money to these developing nations. So that way, if you really do want them to steer away from using these oils of the past or fuels of the past, then they really can do it. They can transition to cleaner energy, to cleaner fuels, to renewables like solar and wind. I mean, especially in the global south, there's, you know, a vast array of land and sunshine. You know, just think about the solar energy that you can get from there, right? And also the wind by the coast. Like, there's so many areas that you can pop some wind farms in. So the main thing is, sadly, it does boil down to money. So if you give the money, then they will no longer need to rely on these things.
Right. And that's certainly that's a great conversation that's being had in the right places. So thank you for that. That's a tough question, I'm well aware. All right, one more tradition. And you're in Europe. We've studied it a little bit, but we love to plant a tree in recognition of your time with us and our guest, and but also just in recognition of your expertise and your contributions. Do you have a favorite place, preferably a forest, that you would like to see a tree planted in your name?
What an amazing initiative, by the way. So great to genuinely actually give back. For me, because when I first got to this country all those years ago, I'm originally from Kenya, by the way. I'm a Kenyan, hence why I can still remember all the Kenyan conferences. When I got to the UK, I was right next to Black Park in Slough, good old-fashioned Slough, whoop whoop for all the people who can remember it. And also it was the main place for the office in the UK. So the office UK was based in Slough as well. I would like it to be planted in Black Park in Slough, please.
Well, we will do that. Wonderful. Thank you. All right. This is that great question that I love to close with. I'm going to give you a chance to tell our listeners about Sustainable Switch newsletter, maybe a question I didn't ask you. Is kind of that great wrap-up question. What did I not ask you that you would like to say?
Gosh, time has flown by. It really does when you're having fun, right? So I would say, please go check out Reuters Sustainable Switch. You can just simply search on it on Google. You can do a quick Google search, or on X, formerly known as Twitter, anywhere you usually search for, and subscribe. It comes out Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays. Fridays are a specific climate focus edition. So do check it out. Or if you're just purely financial and investor driven, then check out our Sustainable Switch offshoot, Sustainable Finance, and that comes out on Wednesdays. Something that you haven't asked me. Maybe why I went from law to journalism, but perhaps it's a story for another time.
I assumed it was obvious, but I'd love to hear that. I think journalism would be a lot more fun than law.
Well, there you go. I guess it's not that much of a difficult question. It really was. Law was just incredibly boring. And I would never have the time to enjoy talking to people such as yourself, to be honest. It was very, you know, focused on just what the client needs and looking at your laptop 24/7 and you're on call 24/7, literally. Like, having to be in the office at 1 or 2 a.m. is something I never want to ever do ever again. So, you know, not to say anything bad for the people in law, people looking to get into it, still very useful. My law degree has been very useful in media too. But yeah, it was just not having that moment to connect with people face-to-face. And I'm more of a face-to-face person.
A great way to kind of train your brain to think in a different way, perhaps in a sequential way. But I'm glad to see, because you're really, that you made that switch, because you're a great voice. And I encourage our listeners to go find Reuters in general and find Sustainable Switch newsletter. And if they follow you a bit on LinkedIn, they would see something else, how bold and brassy you are, because you actually came out against Manchester United on LinkedIn. So I was proud of you.
Thank you. And Arsenal beat them again. We did it again. A proud position.
Well, yes. Sharon, thank you so much for taking time. I know you're busy, and thank you for joining us as a guest on Path to Zero.
No, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
As you might recall, a few episodes ago, I announced that we'll be releasing my first book during Climate Week in New York City in September. You can now pre-order the Path to Zero book on Amazon or wherever you buy your books. You can learn more about the book on my author landing page at PathToZeroBook.com. Thanks again for joining us, and I'll see you next time on Path to Zero.
Thank you for listening to Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to PathToZero@propane.com.